Everyone, any member of Parliament and other public is entitled to attend these proceedings. Can I just finish this? But we'll try to end at 12:15. On the other hand, we are not entirely victims of time or creatures of time, and depend entirely on the proceedings as to whether we convene after lunch, in which case we will make some arrangements for some kind of informal arrangements. So that, in fact, we may aim to start again at 2 o'clock if we have not finished. Welcome the fifth interaction of the Ad Hoc Committee Chapter 9 Associated Institutions. And a particular welcome delegation from Office of Public Protector, Advocate Mushwana, Public Protector, Advocate Shai, Deputy Public Protector, Mrs. Mogaledi, Acting Chief Accounting Officer, Mr. Dokrat, Chief Finance Officer, Advocate Furi, Head of Special Investigations, and Mrs. Toke, Chief Executive Manager, Provincial Coordination. On your left, you will find the members of the committee appointed by the National Assembly, Ms. Johnson, Mr. Simmons, Advocate Masuta, Dr. Anil Shah, Dr. Sumia, Mr. Van der Merwe, Mr. Duterte, and Ms. Mohamed Simmons. The apology is from Mr. Delport, Dr. Delport, and Dr. Rajbali, Mr. Rajbali. They are both performing very important functions associated with Parliament. Although the Speaker has said that these proceedings have priority, but they have very important functions performed in Parliament. Please, we must do it for the Secretary, please. We have to have a degree of formality. But we have not heard from Ms. Mutz officially, have we? No. So, we expect Ms. Mutz to come. Sorry, these are official proceedings of Parliament and Committee. If you want to intimate a note, pass it on to the Secretary, please. We are fairly informal, Mushwana, but there has to be some formality in these, because these are official hearings of Parliament. So it's important to note, therefore, Advocates, that the work of this committee represents one of the most significant activities in Parliament's general oversight function since Parliament's inception over 12 years ago. A very important element in this, and this is why we have this degree of formality. The second point, and members of the committee will forgive me, they have heard this before, but I have had to change the words. But I have to say this to everyone, to all the bodies. This is not an inquisition. An inquisition would take place possibly before the portfolio committee or a judicial hearing. This is not in guiding its deliberations. The committee turns to its terms of reference. A central feature of terms of reference. Then secondly, adopted by the assembly. Then the questionnaire we sent out last December, administered by the committee. We've looked at your annual reports also. Some of us have looked at your 5 years reports, otherwise last year's reports. And of course, we've received various representations made by non-governmental organizations and individuals. These are the basis for this. Now, it's quite clear from the provision of the interim and the final constitution that public protector is regarded as one of the most important constitutional bodies supporting democracy. In fact, the president spoke at a meeting of the International Association of Ombuds Men and Women, and he said that this is essential to a democratic order. So the committee's function, therefore, is to turn to the terms of reference. Basically, the terms of reference says we look at the efficiency, the efficacy of the Office of Public Protector, its relevance, its professionalism in after 12 years, and in meeting the needs of our society. In particular, Article 181.1, where organs of state, which includes that part of the assembly, must ensure that the independence, the impartiality, the dignity, and they use the word the efficacy of these Chapter 9 institutions. So the format and tone of these proceedings, Advocate Mushwana, is that the copies of your submission circulated to members of the committee, therefore will not require you to make an opening statement. We've made one concession, but there's a concession around the other age. But otherwise, there's no opening statement. The committee will not be asking you to report on individual cases. That's an inquisition. And these will not be referred to in responses. That does not fall under a term of reference. It's a broad picture we're looking at. It's important, though, that discussions and questions are exploratory at this stage. Please remember this, and particularly for the journalists who write headlines. Do not construe in any way decisions of the committee. So there are questions that may be asked. Implicit in that may be an answer, but that is not the position of the committee. So they're not a position of recommendation of the committee. These will be captured in the committee's reports of the National Assembly after extensive deliberations. Now, what we have done, in order to not take it by surprise, is that because the fee covered 11 institutions, very extensive, we've asked two members of the committee to, not to specialize, but to particularly assist the committee in taking the questions at the beginning. And so the Honourable, this is parliamentary language, by the way, Honourable, but we're all Honourable, including the members of this audience here, the Honourable Stanley Simmons and the Honourable Carol Johnson lead the discussions, but our members of the committee will. Now, please, we follow the approach laid down in our questionnaire, in your response. It is very important that we follow that particular approach. Now, the normal custom is when we look at the first one, and I ask the first question on role and functions. You state, right at the beginning, that the public protector is complying with the principles of cooperative governance, especially the need to cooperate with other organs of state in all spheres of government in mutual trust and good faith. This is page 3. Now, apart from the constitutional provision that good governance applies to three spheres of government, not organs that exist, apart from the fact that it applies to three spheres, the legislative, judiciary, and the executive, and the local government and provincial government. If you, in fact, rely on this base fee, is there not a severe tension between the requirements of good governance, cooperation, mutual trust and good faith? Is there not a severe tension between this principle and the requirement to investigate misconduct, maladministration of organs of state without fear, favor, or prejudice? Is there not a tension between the fact that you rely on page 3 on this idea of that you will subscribe to the principles of good governance, and on the other hand, you're obliged under the constitution and legislation to investigate misconduct by the administration of the state without fear, favor, or prejudice? By the way, I told you the grilling would be very tough, by the way.
Thank you, Chair, firstly for giving us this opportunity to appear before you. I will not be the only one who will answer this question. And obviously in this particular question, I would also expect advocate for it to make an input in it. They all have participated in the drafting of the responses. But just for a start, for the question of cooperative governance, you will have noticed that throughout the South African Constitution, cooperative governance runs through the whole Constitution. By cooperation, it must not be understood that there must be an understanding or an agreement on how we should do our work. You will notice that we are given extensive powers within the Public Protectors Act and the Constitution to carry out our investigation, for instance, conducting searches, entering premises, and we have very seldom used this process because of the cooperation that we received from the government departments. For instance, since I came in, we have only issued two subpoenas to specific departments, but we withdraw them because they immediately cooperated with us. In other words, what we are trying to illustrate here is that we work in such a manner that we become acceptable to the government in the sense that they understand what we are looking for and cooperate with us by submitting the necessary information as we request them to do. It must not be understood to mean that we say, look, we have got a working relationship whereby we must not move hard on them. We don't. I just wanted to...
Otherwise, but in the basis in which you work is that it must not be an antagonistic relationship. But we'll tease this out later when it comes to this. And now, Ms. Johnson and Ms. Simmons.
Thanks, Jay. On your understanding of your legal and constitutional mandate, and I think you can guess what question is going to follow, but you know that there's been significant criticism from, amongst others, the Public Service Accountability Monitor, where they say, and I'm quoting from one of their reports, the Public Protector's Office has been generally weak, particularly with regard to oversight over the executive, because, they argue, the Public Protector's Office interprets their mandate too narrowly. Now, I don't think you've had an opportunity to respond to that publicly, and I would like you to do so, and to explain to the committee how you view your legal mandate.
Thank you. I've had that criticism, not only from the public accountability people only. I must state that there is currently a matter in court that will deal specifically with that particular issue, how we interpreted our mandate, whether or not that was narrowly. It will be of interest for us to know the view of the court, how they look at this. But because that criticism, unfortunately, came in line with two particular cases, and unfortunately, if I listen to what the chair said, that we cannot discuss specific cases, because in order for me to sufficiently answer your question to dispute what they are saying, I necessarily have to refer to the facts of the cases. And because we can't refer to specific cases, I'm not sure how I would answer that. But I do have an answer that statement is firstly not supported or substantiated by facts and evidence before us. And I can call it a sweeping statement, because at no stage that statement referred to law, referred to a fact, so that they can, on that basis, impute that to me. That's how I deal with matters. Secondly, you will see throughout these cases where they say we interpret our mandate narrowly or we're not independent, they will refer to about two or three cases. And if you have seen in our statistics, in the past 4 or 5 years, you'll see that we have handled and finalized over 50,000 cases. And nobody says anything about those cases.
We come to that in a moment. Now, can I just say that, in fact, if you answer in broad lines, broad conditions, that's perfect, broad approach. Can I say, it was very hot. Could we, in fact, if you want to check it, check yourself. But may I ask you, you see, the part of the problem we have is that your responses have been very general. Large extracts from legislation. And large extracts from your program of action. And that is why we're going to ask you specific questions. And your responses. Now, could we just make sure that would one of the information secretaries give up a seat to Mrs. Canberra, please? Ms. Canberra, could you sit where the two women are sitting, one of them? Can you give up your seat, please, one of them? So we don't confuse anything. Yeah. No. I'm talking Mrs. Canberra. Would you like, because this is for the committee. It's here. Would you like to sit where one of the information officers is? And Ms. Smuts can then join us in the seat. Welcome, Ms. Smuts. Would you like to join them, please? Because I want to make a distinction between those who are present and those who are members of the committee. Would you give up one of your seats, please, right? She needs a desk. Miss Cameron needs a desk. So will you give up your seats, please, right? No, put the chair back, please. Put the chair where it was. Please, can I say it in plain English? Terrazzo, could you give up your seat, please? Just give up your seat, please. And Ms. Campbell will take your seat first. Thank you. Thank you. So, please, your answers have been, your responses have been very wide, right? And therefore we'll be asking specific questions. Ms. Johnson, we're still on the question one. Yes, thanks.
Thank you. Moving on to page 10 of the document, you mentioned that there's a perceived overlap between your role and that of the South African Human Rights Commission. Your statistics show that presently you are receiving more complaints from members of the public than the Human Rights Commission, although the Human Rights Commission's caseload is increasing by an average of 20% per annum. The number of cases, are you experiencing a similar increase in caseload, or does your caseload seem to have stabilized?
If you look at our statistics, although we, you know, in our annual report, you'll see that there was a rise of cases from 2002, 2003, 2004, and they began to go down a little bit. And I would say the workload at the moment has stabilized in the sense that we are able to deal with them. But because of the approach that we are adopting in terms of dealing with these cases, one would say the workload has increased. And what I mean there is that we have begun to make sure that for every case that we finalize, there is a closing report or a special report that we submit to Parliament or a report that we submit to a particular ministry. So the process of writing a report in itself consumes a lot of time. That is coupled with the fact that we also have a number of visiting points under our outreach, which also takes the time of our investigators in going to this visiting point. One will say, yes, the workload is increasing, and in particular that we are looking for the root cause. We are not only interested, if you are coming to complain about the pension, we're not only interested in you getting the pension, we are interested on why was it necessary for you to wait for a year and have to come to us for the pension. it so that we investigate the root cause. While we get the money, we go to the root cause. So that increases the workload.
Just a bit for the committee. The decline in cases received in 2004-05, 22,350. In 2005-2006, 17,450. That's an enormous number of cases, but still. Please could you explain why the decline took place? Cases brought forward 2004-2005, 9,000, round figure, 9,000. Cases taken forward 2005-06, 14,000. The second question. So while the cases declined in 2005-06, explanation for that, the number of cases brought forward increased by 25% to 14,000. Now, it's an enormous caseload, it's true, but that's a function. Could you explain why there's a fall in one and an increase in the other?
Thank you. I had already started answering that question in terms of our approach. Where, for instance, when somebody comes and complains about a pension, and once the pension is paid out, the matter is closed. That has been the approach. And what we are doing now is to say, look, but why was it necessary for this person to come to the Office of the Public Protector? In other words, we are looking for the root cause in a particular department to determine whether or not we should institute what we call a systemic investigation. If you have a number of similar cases coming from one particular department, that in itself suggests that there is a systemic problem. And what we do there, you will see that we can begin to conduct a systemic investigation. The writing of reports itself, as I've indicated, takes a lot of time of our average investigators who were previously only concluding cases without writing reports. And the process of writing reports, why we are writing reports, is to enable anybody who wants to assess the quality of the work that comes from the Office of the Public Protector. How do you check? Why do I have all advocates in my office? What for? You need to be able to look at the quality of the report that we produce. You need to look at the impact that we bring into the department. And that you only do by submitting a report. You will have seen even in today's August. If it was in the past, I would have concluded that method to say, look, the person is released, it's fine, and not write a report. But we went on to investigate the root cause. That in itself has partly contributed to the numbers of cases that are carried over to increase in that manner. But because we see that as moving, we have started to develop a strategy, as you will see at the end of this financial year. The cases that are carried over have declined because we have now decided to design a plan to reduce them. For instance, we'll be working in our Western Cape office tomorrow and Friday to deal specifically with these particular cases where the cases are in.
We look at the delays in a moment. That's a different section in response. But on behalf of the committee, I have to ask you this. Obviously, there can be a pattern of abuse and misbehavior by affected departments, right? And that you carry out inquiry. But one of the complaints we've received has been the delay in both the investigation, the follow-up, and the reports. Now, is there another distinction to be made where there's a systemic failure which requires, by a consultant or somebody else, an investigation, and a speedy response to a particular social welfare, social security complaint? Now, in other words, do I take it that you merge the systemic problems with the individual application, or do I take it that the systemic one would be looked at separately so that to expedite the response to the question on behalf of the committee?
Thank you, Chair. I think you have partly answered the question. There are particular departments where it becomes extremely difficult to get answers speedily. I'll give an example of appeals. Appeals is one of the nightmares. There's a big bulk of number of cases that comes from appeals. As you know, with a change in the legal system where certain appeals cases are automatically appealable, there is a lot of cases, and we are busy with a systemic investigation, criminal appeals. And there are a number of cases which also constitute the big chunk of this matter, and we are towards the end of our systemic investigation in that particular. And part of it is that because of the change of that law, you find that people in the prison authorities, correctional services, they don't know the processes that have been followed. We have conducted workshops, for instance, in the Free State, on appeals itself to say, look, what procedure do you follow when you receive an appeal? And things are beginning to change. You go to UIF, you also struggle to get answers in time. You'll go from one office to the other office, and in the process, the other experience that you get, as you correspond with a particular manager, director in a session, that manager changes too quickly, and then you start all over again and again. And the bigger chunk too is your pension. Pension is one singular problem in the country as a whole, particularly with the establishment of the pension dealing with local government staff, and then you have got staff that work for the government, and their pensions have been transferred to local government. It's a nightmare.
We'll come to the process, please, in a moment, as to how you investigate and all that. We'll come to that in a moment. We'll come to that, but do not take it for the record, but you will not hold up an investigation of particular complaints while you're looking at the systemic, so that's what we'll clarify that then. So that will speed up the proceedings too. The question here is very important for the committee. You have very wide terms of reference where people can complain to you. But you have also a very important power under Section 4A. You can, in your own initiative, investigate. Can you tell us in the last 10, 12 years, on your own initiative, how many cases? This is, in fact, your son's role and function. I was sticking to the role and function. On your own initiative, how many cases are aptly issues about cases? Because although you have advocates, we don't have cases. We have issues and issues. How many, your predecessor and all, how many have you investigated in the last 12 years?
I wouldn't know for the last 12 years because there has not been much information on that. But
memory then. Seriously.
Yes, but if you look in our annual report, we have listed our own initiative in year to year, how many own initiatives we have in our strategic document, both our stress plan. We set out that there must be a minimum of so many cases. I don't have figures because I didn't anticipate this question. But we do indicate clearly a minimum that each office or the office of as a whole must carry out an own initiative investigation. And in our report at the end of the year, we do indicate own initiative cases that we have investigated, that we have concluded. And you will understand there is also a limitation, because if you are to open a newspaper, for example, there will be thousands and thousands of cases which you really feel you can take them. And because of our capacity, it's not possible to follow up every matter that you might find in a newspaper. Appeals, for instance, is our own initiative investigation.
But third parties may refer matter. But look at page 69, there's 2.5 cases which you investigated, because one was withdrawn. Any reports? There's 2.5 cases then. One was the investigation head of the Metro Police, the other one was improperly affairs of China of Metro Police, and then a complaint against the Department of Justice, directed to the Department of Labor, that was withdrawn. So it's 2.5 cases then. So we take it then that your office might be able to supply us, say over a period of 5 years of where you've acted, with a brief two or three lines on your initiative. We're finishing with Mr. Johnson and Mr. Simmons. Yes, Mr. Simmons.
Thank you, Chair. I find a contradiction in what the public protector just said in his reply, in that he said that the caseloads has stabilized and is there's a decline. But if you look at paragraph 8.11 of his response, he indicates that the number of complaints received by his office are increasing. Perhaps you could comment on that. And then, has the Office of the Public Protector been able to make a projection of immediate and future capacity requirements? Because you said you had a problem with that. Also keeping in mind the problem of with regard to the retention of skilled staff.
We are just jumping. I'll go after the committee. Do they have any questions on the first point then? Other than the committee. We are now trespassing further. So can we just finish this institutional arrangements with the question one, and then we'll move on. Yes, Advocate Mrs.
Thank you, Chairperson. In your earlier questions, you alluded specifically to the power that public protector enjoys. If you look at Section 182.1, A and B are very specific in relation to investigation on the one hand and reporting, but C is much wider. It says that to take appropriate remedial action. Now that could imply many things. Now I just wanted to find out how the public protector has interpreted, how wide the public protector has interpreted this in terms of approaching different cases. I think in the one instance, in the one instance, I think the public protector gave us the specific example of social grants where the remedial action would include restoring or ensuring that the grant is actually restored to the beneficiary. Are there other instances where other forms of remedial action has been achieved beyond reporting and investigating?
Thank you. Remedial action will differ from case to case depending on what case. For instance, in this one that we saw on the paper, we have recommended to the Department of Justice to say, look, because of this very clear violation of this person's rights, instead of waiting for this person to institute an action where it is clear it's the fault of the department, we are recommending an ex gratia grant. What we have seen is that sometimes as government officials, even where we see we are clearly wrong, we'll go on and defend a matter which is clearly wrong, and in the end, still the taxpayer will suffer. So, if you have seen, for instance, in the high-profile cases, we have made specific recommendations. And you will see when the president responds to our recommendation, already he will give an indication of how he wants a particular matter to be resolved. In his letter that goes to parliament, in there he does specify exactly that. For instance, he will say, I've given instruction to the secretary to carry out this particular issue. From our part, when we make a recommendation, each manager in the investigative unit where a report has been issued and the report contains a recommendation, each manager on a quarterly basis report, because it is now an audit requirement that quarterly we need to report on the achievement and successes of our strategic objectives as contained in our stress plan. So in our reporting, we do indicate where have we succeeded, where have which department has implemented what. Like, for instance, we are in the process of in one matter in the Free State where we have made a recommendation, and an indication is that no, we are not going to implement this recommendation, and we are moving on the, we are taking the process to follow up our recommendation. So we do. And talking about remedial action, you'll see that at the cornerstone there, there is room for conciliation, mediation, which is also in cases where we have started as the Office of the Public Protector to bring parties together, because a negotiated settlement has a potential of restoring relationship than hardening relationship. So we see that also as the mandate of the public protector, not to be only punitive, but to be such that you are able to reconcile people, you negotiate a settlement, you negotiate a payment. Recently we negotiated a payment where somebody was paid 30,000 instead of going to a court of law. So that's how broadly we see the mandate.
That's remedial action. No, Mr. Palmer. We still on first question,
Thank you, Chairperson. I want to return to the words remedial action. To me, it's very important. Now, I had a case where I reported to you, and you took swift action against a certain minister who, despite numerous letters, ignored me for almost a year. Now, fine. Remedial action was taken immediately. I had what I was waiting on for a year within a few days. But now the question is, what do you do to that minister? What teeth do you have? Do you make a finding? Does she get something on an SAP 69 previous conviction? What are your teeth? The remedial action. What hiding do you give the person who contravened?
Perhaps you have to pay to get a hiding,
brother. I think the question that you're asking is very important and perhaps very fundamental to the office of an ombudsman, not only in South Africa, but in all other countries. For instance, if you look at other countries like Ghana, they've got, when they give a decision, their decisions have got a force of law. They can enforce their decision. That's why with us, you see from the Constitution and the Act that we can only recommend. It's very emphasizes we recommend a remedial action. And it was a challenge to us. I saw that as a challenge to us.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, because this happens all Chapter 9 bodies. Only then I have to ask you this question. If it's a very serious matter and you make a recommendation, the condition not followed, do you not have other armory? I mean, you make annual reports. You're allowed under the Act to make a special report to Parliament. How many occasions in the last 5 years has a special report been made, say, for example, in the area like Mr. Van der Merwe's one? Because here, what I call the oxygen of publicity. Right? Now, there's press conferences, there's press issues. How many occasions in the last 5 years in the context of Mr. Van der Merwe's, I ask this to everyone, have you made a special report to Parliament with a request for a special debate on that issue?
Yeah, thanks, Chair. I want to refer to a case where the Chair was the complainant. The Chair made a complaint to the public protector on communications in the department, said, why does it take long for this thing to happen, that thing to happen? And we conducted an intensive investigation. We tabled the report, and we kept on following up what is Parliament doing about this report. We made specific recommendations that must be followed and tabled it in Parliament. It was only after about 3 years, that Parliament called us now to come and talk to that report which we tabled long ago. All I'm saying is that we also need Parliament to come to our assistance. For as long as we only have to recommend, because what we do is, if the minister does not implement our recommendation, our remedy is to come back to Parliament, so that Parliament can, through a committee, summon that minister in terms of your own powers to question that particular minister or department, why are you not implementing X? And one of the matters is on its way to Parliament to request precisely that.
Just for the record, it took 2 years for your office to deal with my complaint against the Ministry of Water Affairs. Your report was only published after I stopped being Minister of Water Affairs. No, that's a very important one. It had enormous influence in government departments, by the way, because I reported to the Cabinet that this was going to happen. So, it has had influence. Complaint was simply, it took the department too long to reply to the public, to other ministers, members of parliament, including the minister also. And this is a complaint. So you can, this is called the Asma Law number one. The shame factor. Yes, Duterte.
Thank you very much, Mr. One of the terms of reference of this committee is to establish whether Chapter 9 and related bodies are suitable for the South African environment, and it goes on. The consumption of resources by them is justified, etc. Now, to the extent that you have, over this period of time, had this workloads, complaints, etc., although we have seen, according to the report that the chair read to us at this time, do you nonetheless, or perhaps would you agree, that you see your role in the future expanding? And quoting from your report prepared by the National Democratic Institute of International Affairs, I don't know if all of us have copies of that, on page 11, that is on behalf of the Public Office of the Public Protector of the Republic. Page 11 says, despite the international trend toward proliferation of combat manned offices, several countries are debating whether to expand or reduce or redefine, I beg your pardon, their current model. Now, you have the Human Rights Commission, you have the Public Service Commission, which you have a memorandum of understanding with, in terms of how you handle complaints from the public, etc. Now, consistent with the provisions of the Act and your role over the last 12, 13 years, do you see your role expanding? Do you see yourself redefining your role to the extent that our democracy has evolved?
Thank you. Obviously, it's a very, very wise question. I will immediately say yes, the role of the Ombudsman, it will continue to be there, particularly if South Africa continue to have this vast majority of people living in the rural areas. That you will continue to have. And I'm saying this because if you look at how the human rights, for instance, operate in the public protector, the public protector specializes on service delivery, which is something that your person at the back of you beyond is looking for. The requests for the IT, the request for disability grant, which is not always forthcoming. People who have been retrenched, who are going to the offices seeking money out of the UIF, with a growing unemployment, that type of duty will just continue. So until the socio-economic of the country have gone or have declined, which it's not in terms of the statistics that you see on unemployment, it's not foreseeable for now. So I do see a role in the Office of the Public Protector. My observation, as I'm also an official in the international bodies of the Ombudsman, there is not a decline. What happens in general is that all countries are beginning to have offices of Ombudsman. For instance, in the past year, we have been called upon to assist Angola to establish the Office of
Ombudsman. Except that, it says in the report. I mean, the question of the debate was, is there a need to redefine aspects of it. I mean, for example, in Ireland there's also appointed an ombudsman for the police. Now they have a super office, a small country, they have an ombudsperson in any case. Now one for the police there. Then one for the health services, an ombudsman. Now these are public areas. In the United Kingdom, which is quite a bigger country, we have an ombudsman for local governments. So the question therefore is, and this assists us, you also had a function in the letter. So delivery is not your primary factor. It's abuse of discretion, maladministration. Now, of course, very important, which we'll come to in a moment, freedom of information, very important. Also corruption, which is all added onto. Now, in other words, like unlike Tiny Tim, you've just grown and grown and grown in 14 years now, right? Now, is there therefore, this is our job, to say, in this context of a development state, is it possible to say the job should be redefined? For example, the delay, the carrying over from 1 year to another, large number of cases causes problems, right? We have a table here about delays, right, in the annual report. Now, the President said, efficient, early decision-making is vital. Well, so now, the first thing I want you to answer that is, do you think in the light of development in other countries, not they're having new ombudsmen, they're having ombudspersons for different areas, do you think there's a need for redefinition of the function of the ombudsman?
Thank you, Chair. I will firstly say, look, I will leave that to the discretion, but I'll talk to the experience of what you have just said about different ombudsmen for the different either departments. I know for a fact that, for instance, in England, there is a move to do away with the proliferation of ombudsmen because the name is beginning to disintegrate. If you look at Australia, for instance, they have even restricted the use of ombudsmen. So, look, it's confusing. If it's not the ombudsman in the traditional sense of the word, they don't allow you to use ombudsman. They say that is an internal mechanism which is supposed to be there in any way, in any department.
Just leave out the description. It's a function we're talking about. How effective is it in a country of 45 million, five times the size of France, to have one office? Remember, you also had functions in relation to the defense force. I don't know what happened to that function. Right? So that has been transferred back, or you're still exercising that. So it's not the description the committee wants to talk about, it's the exercise of the function in the country of our size.
Well, for the defense, as you have mentioned, I know they are in the process of establishing an ombudsman. The only thing that we commented on is when they had a clause that was overriding the function of the public protector. So, look, you need to change the constitution if you want to achieve that one. But there is nothing really stopping any department to have its own ombudsman if we want to have it as a sectorial body. But what will happen eventually is that you will not have the notion of ombudsman in its classical sense. What you will be having bodies which, in the constitution, as you see, the office of the ombudsman is an office of last resort. In other words, we say you must exhaust your internal remedies that are available to you before you approach the office of the ombudsman. So if you have this different smaller ombudsman, then you will not have that superstructure where when everything else is failed, you are going to resort to.
Yeah, Chairperson, the question might be slightly outside of the scope covered in chapter, sorry, in page 10 of question.
The committee, Ms. Johnson, Ms. Simmons, have you finished the one? Let's finish it then.
In relation to that specific point.
Yeah,
I think one of the questions. But I'm prefixing it by saying, The question relates to the relationship between the public protector and other subdomains.
It's a very simple section.
Yes, it's
later. Yeah, it's a central part of it.
Okay.
Yeah, did you have the replies?
Yeah,
this is here. Ms. Johnson, Mr. Simmons?
Thanks, Chair. Just on page 17, you argue that your enabling legislation will require amendments to streamline your investigation process. Could you elaborate?
Chair, thank you. If I may, I'm Stoffel Fourie, Head of Special Investigations. The Public Protector Act, was last amended in 1998. The amendments took place because of certain changes in the Constitution, and what we found now is that if we compare ourselves in terms of a benchmarking against other countries, developing offices in other countries in the Ombudsman area, we find that we are lagging behind to a certain extent in the way that we, for example, describe our investigation functions in our Act. We also have areas where we need some changes. For example, the Public Protector Act still provides that the Public Protector can be a judge, or has to be a judge, and then it works down to other occupations. The question that now obviously comes to the fore is, in the light of the judgment of the courts in relation to the Special Investigating Unit and Judge Heath, is that still valid in terms of the constitutional dispensation and how it's interpreted? We're not saying yes or no, but that is an area that we have to consider in terms of when we look at the amendment of our legislation. But the point that we really are making is the amendments that we are talking about is very small issues. It's not that we're going to try and change the powers and functions and the definition of what the public protector is. It's merely a fact of looking at those areas where we think we can improve, and to make those suggestions to Parliament to assist us in that regard.
Forgive me, it's a piffling approach to make those changes, because the Parliament is taking into account that you shouldn't appoint a judge. The most substantial issue is that the condition for appointment has to be that you must be a member of Parliament for 10 years, isn't it? One of the conditions. Now, that's the most substantial matter. This is something that we will look at in our own discussions. Is it still relevant? Well, of course, in many countries in the world, there's a condition that you have to be an existing civil servant, for example, to be an ombudsperson. But would you like to react as to whether it's one of the conditions taken into account, but you must have served 10 years in Parliament? Why not 10 years as a dustman, or 10 years as a psychologist? Why should it be 10 years in Parliament?
Chair, I think we'll leave that up to Parliament to decide on eventually. But
good civil servant, he's been diplomatic.
Thanks. Just to find out, how does the Office of the Public Protector measure whether the impact that you're having on government departments, successful implementations of remedial action? Do you go back to see whether departments have actually implemented? Do you keep an eye on departments, or do you solve it and leave it at that?
Yes, we're not talking cases today, but if I can just, in broad terms, give a little bit of an example. We made, for example, recently recommendations in regard to disciplinary action that should be taken in terms of a code of conduct. Now, of course, we will give the entity concerned reasonable time to go through the motions and the procedures, but we will then start following up, let's say, depending on the type of case, within a period of 3 to 6 weeks, to find out from the person at the head of that institution what is being done, until such time as we are convinced that the recommendation has now been implemented. And if not, we will of course then take it to a higher authority. Let's say it was a municipal council, and the municipal council is not performing its duty in terms of our recommendation. We will then take it to the provincial government in terms of the provisions of the constitution and ask them to look into it and then eventually report to Parliament. A matter like that, of course, where there is a failure to implement our recommendation, will also be referred to in our annual report to Parliament.
In order to make sure, because for us that is critical, otherwise, I mean, if our recommendations are not implemented, we may as well not be there. You will see in all our threat plan, we have got a strategic objective which specifically requires every manager where a report has been issued to follow out the implementation and to report on a quarterly basis as we report on the achievement in each strategic objective. So it's even there as part of a strong mandate to all managers to follow up with the implementation of recommendations.
Thank you, Chair. The public sector must be accessible to all persons and communities. Taking in mind the vast area of some of our provinces, especially the rural areas, can the public sector elaborate on what practical programs his office has and he intends to implement to ensure its visibility and thereby ensuring that all citizens know about the role and functions of the office?
The macro social policy document published by the government, a very important document, says two of the most important bodies in the Constitution, Chapter 9, the Human Rights Commission and the Public Protector. The people that canvassed, 50% of them, had never heard of these two offices. Had never heard of them. Did not know where they were. They'd never heard of it. And that's a very serious matter, 40 years on. That's one of our terms of reference. So when you answer Mr. Simmons' question, you might bear that in mind, that 50% of those canvassed. And we are carrying out our own survey, by the way, next month. So we will be able to find out ourselves too.
Yeah, before I give it to Shirley to answer that, because we are also looking at these figures. For instance, in one of the NGOs, there was an indication that a presidential, report indicated that 73% of the population in South Africa does not know about the Office of the Public Protector. One would not want to contest that because statistics, it's what it is, or the owner is. Yeah. I will just give our side of the story and then you will decide whether the figures are correct. For instance, we have the 9 provincial offices which are spread in all our cities, which are the highest populated areas. And then we also have the national office which is located in Pretoria. And then we have 6 regional offices which is a subdivide into the various regions. And we are now creating 2 more regional offices, which is in the Eastern Cape and I think also the Northern Cape, that vast area. And then over and above that, we have over 73 visiting points, which we do have a list here, which we visit at least once or twice a month to meet with the people, popularize the Office of the Public Protector. That is an attempt to reach out to the people. These 73 visiting points are located in the rural, in the most rural areas, where we don't have offices, where we meet people to talk to them. So I'm not saying this is enough. I'm just saying as we look at this 73%, we must bear in mind these realities. That's where we are as we speak today. And I will ask Shirley to give further elaboration on our outreach strategy and where we are in terms of that one.
Thank you, Chair. The public protector has already alluded to the clinic that we are conducting. When we started in 2004, we started with 43 clinics. And then in 2004-05, we had 28 clinics. And then out of those 28 clinics, we received plus minus over 1,000 cases. That shows that people are aware of our offices. And then in terms of our outreach program, we identify stakeholders like our CBOs, our NGOs, as well as government departments. And then to ensure that people know about our offices. We conduct workshops and public awareness, because if people don't know about our offices, they cannot access or even change their rights.
The committee has to accept the fact that if the government publishes a document, we have to accept the validity of that. And this is a problem of Bosford. I must tell you this. We'll put the same questions to everyone, right? And I said the same thing about the macro social policy document, which you should, all of you should read very carefully, because it's a very important one. But the fact is that nearly every country in the world, people don't know about this institution. What we are asking now is to be a little bit more self-critical, to assist the committee, to how we can correct it. I mean, for example, there are ways of doing things. There are millions of leaflets which should be put in post offices, which I've done when I talked about their parents' rights in schools. 2 million leaflets in post offices. And most people do go to post offices. They do go to welfare offices, right? And that's where it's cheaper than setting up regional offices, which will come to in a moment, by the way. So there are ways of expanding knowledge. We'll come to that later. Are we completing now, Ms. Johnson? Now, yes, Mr. Taylor, and then Mr. Matsua.
On the very same question, that is question two, Chairperson. The Office of the Public Protector suggests that the overlap between its functions and the functions of other bodies, Public Service Commission, Human Rights Commission, etc., that overlap is very slight, if not absent at all. Now, you have a memorandum of understanding with the Public Service Commission, where you delineate your roles and responsibilities, you deal with complaints from the public, they'll deal with complaints from the civil servants, etc. And broadly, as part of the drive against corruption in the public sector, let's talk about the public sector for now, although it is quite pervasive as we know. Why is it that you think that there is no overlap between the role that you play and, say, the Public Service Commission, or perhaps even the Human Rights Commission? And yet, according to this report prepared on behalf of the Office of the Public Protector 7 years ago, reference is made to the drive against corruption and, obviously, the President's selling leadership in all of those things. Now, could you explain why is it that you think there is no overlap, and yet it is quite glaring, and of course, there's a memorandum that I've referred to.
Can we dispose of this then? Because I think we dispose of this issue of overlap and relationship. Because I associate with this, you say at page 31, a lot has to be done to improve collaboration, Human Rights Commission, and gender equality. Can you elaborate on that? What kind of steps should be taken 12, 14 years later? And why have they not been taken in relation to that? So it's overlap and collaboration. Then we dispose of this altogether. We move on to Parliament. Yes, of course. Can we take a question now, too?
As I said, Chairperson, my question might be slightly outside of the framework of that specific question, in that the question locates us within the Chapter 9 institutions, the relationship between them. But there are constitutional institutions in other chapters where the issue of collaboration and overlap arises. You would recall, and I won't deal with specifics, that you have appeared in another ad hoc committee in Parliament, where the issue of overlap specifically arose, in this case, it was the Chapter 8 institution. Have you been able to develop a proper framework within which to enhance collaboration and cooperation?
That's a good question, then. That's fair enough. And we dispose of this, then. Okay. The last one is not only Chapter 9, there are other bodies, too. The first two questions are, can we dispose of this?
Thank you. I think Stoffel will also add to this one. I think the one thing that did not come out clear from Shelley you know, how we deal with the issue around post office and what have you, to reach out to the people. With the CSAP program, the civil society program that has now been established in our office, we have appointed a directorate now in our office to deal with outreach. The EU is funding this program for the next 2 years and will be facing it into the program of the Office of the Public Protector. And that's the advice that we are giving will be what we will be focusing in, because now it is working on the terms of reference. I just thought that we have put that in place already. Now, coming to the issue around the overlap between the Public Service Commission and us, I think maybe overlap there, the way it has been used, is that because we have now separated on our own, we have now separated what we can do and what the public service can do. There is no collision between us. Not that the constitution, I mean, in terms of our powers. The powers are clear. There's nothing stopping me, for instance, from taking a complaint from a civil servant who has got a complaint. I can do that. But because of the memorandum of understanding, there is no overlap. But in terms constitutionally and the provisions, there is that overlap. The reality is that there is. That was merely intended to say, look, because of the agreement, we no longer collide in the operation. But the overlap is there, and it does need to be clarified. How do we separate the two? And lastly, Stoffel will elaborate on this. You see, when we come to collaboration, overlap with human rights, you know, if you look at exactly what the human rights does, you know, the promotion of the human, you know, you look at the outcome. What do we do as the Office of the Public Protector? Where we conduct an investigation and make a recommendation for remedial action, which I don't think any of the Chapter 9 institutions do. What they are looking mainly at is the promotion of the culture of human rights in the country. And you'll see that the cases that they handle relate mainly to the practice. It's something which has now become a practice. That's where you see the Human Rights Commission comes in. But this is a question that Stoffel dealt with extensively.
Thank you, Jay. I was fortunate to have been in the office in 95, 96 when it started, and shortly after the two commissions and ourselves commenced our operations, we had this very concern. How are we going to deal with the person that lodges the same complaint with all three of us? And we had a conference about this, and we came to an understanding that in terms of the promotion and the monitoring and assessing of gender and human rights issues, we would refer matters to the commission where from an investigation or for the complaint, it is obvious that what we are talking about is a tendency of human rights abuse in a particular department or institution. Where there is an isolated incident, we would deal with that incident but in terms of the Public Protector Act, investigate and make remedial action. But I think in terms of overlap, one should really look at the practical situation. And from where we sit, I cannot think of many cases where we can say that there was an overlap in the sense that where there was a difficulty with the overlap situation. A practical example is the clothing of residential areas for purposes of crime prevention. We received a few complaints about that, and at that very time, the Human Rights Commission was conducting hearings in that regard, and they were doing a broader investigation, and we referred the complainants to the Human Rights Commission, and they made submissions to them, which were taken into account in the eventual report. I don't think we deny that there can be better collaboration between the institutions, but I also think that one tends to forget that the biggest investigation ever conducted in the New South Africa was just that. It was a collaboration between the Public Protector's Office.
You must answer this question. The question is not specific. You say a lot has still to be done to improve collaboration.
Yes.
The question, please, can we have a direct answer? What kind of steps should you take? And why haven't they been taken? And, for granted, no? Can we have a direct answer to that? We're going around and around. Right? Let's have a direct answer.
steps to be taken, I think we can have better communication between the institutions. We can meet on a more regular basis. If we have the capacity, we can identify more investigations on own initiative where we can all be involved, submit joint reports to Parliament. I think, Chair, to answer your second question, why hasn't it happened? The institutions, if you look at the history of our office, for example, we started off very, very small. And we were still in the process of establishing ourselves, setting up offices in the provinces, trying to be accessible. And I don't think we've really had the capacity and the time to explore this more fully. Now that we have a more stronger office, I think we will be in a better position to do
that. You see, one of the terms of reference specifically is
collaboration
between Chapter 9 and associated bodies. Our experience so far has been, it's not a finding, our experience has been that it's largely, in fact, publicity thing, that there is collaboration. Our experience so far has been that there is real collaboration in joint campaigns, joint activities, joint reporting, that kind of thing, right? So, you've answered the question. You will take measures, you don't know what those measures are going to be, to increase the collaboration. Thank you.
Can I clarify that picture? You are right in saying, what have we done so far in terms of dealing with collaboration? There were many reasons why it was impossible to effectively collaborate, because firstly, our strengths were not the same in terms of the spread. You will find that the public protector has got more offices in the district, and the gender will have only 2 offices. And on a day-to-day basis of operation, in all your various offices, there will be matters relating to gender where they should be collaborating. And there is no structure at the local level, at that particular level. And now that the gender person has covered the country almost last year, they've got all the offices. And with this CISAP program, the aim of the EU study was to bring the 3 institutions in this case to operate together. That's why the program is a joint operation of the human rights, the public protector, and gender. To improve that collaboration, it's a joint program. And for instance, as we establish offices now, we make sure that in our offices, there is an office of the gender in George, for instance. When we established that office at George, we made provision for the gender and for the human rights, so that if somebody comes to that office and it's a human rights problem, the person is referred immediately. We have done the same in Siyabuswa. We are doing the same in the Northern Cape. We are housing the Gender Commission there, and in all future offices where space permits, we accommodate them. We have conducted an investigation, for instance, on maintenance cases, where we jointly with the Gender Commission conducted that collaboration. So we are saying that's still not enough. And
you will, because you see, our reports have been very general on this. The richness comes out in the questions. We didn't know you were doing this. Huh? You still haven't answered the question what you'll do. Let me give an example, you see. Parliament passed legislation, which is enormously important, like freedom of information legislation. One of the unintended consequences is that nobody actually tries to find out whether it's working. Now, the submissions we've received say, the Human Rights Commission has jurisdiction, you have jurisdiction. Now, what should have happened in a well-ordered society is that the immediate law was passed. There should be an agreement between the Human Rights Commission and the public protector to say, this is how this act will be enforced. This is how it will be protected. This is how the mischief will be cured. Isn't that so? So at present, we have a very painful representation. Say, the only people who can get information they want are those who can afford to go to court, which has happened, big cases. But ordinary people, Joe Stone, Lanini, seeks information about very important areas, and the departments don't even have a proper system to deal with the freedom of information legislation. So we are throwing this out, that because we need, how is legislation being implemented? That's one of the reports of parliaments. And we will use, as one of the case studies, the Freedom of Information legislation. Because there's concurrent jurisdiction. Right? And we have thought that from the public point of view, there would have been absolute clarity as to how this would be dealt with. Ms. Johnson.
Chair, is it all right if we move on to the budgetary constraints facing your mandate? I'm on page 21 of the document.
Mr. Advocate's question. Law on Chapter 9 bodies.
What's the cooperation?
You know, Chapter 10, 11, 12, Bank 12.
I would say, for instance, other Chapter 9 institutions like your Auditor General, we operate generally in terms of what the law says we can do. There is no specific arrangement between us. We have not entered into any arrangement other than what he was referring to, the joint investigation that we had, the NPA, and the Auditor General. That was one specific case. I think the nature of cases that we get also decides the nature of collaboration. And some of the cases, you will find that you don't even need the NPA, because the Act will say, if I find that there is a crime that has been committed, I immediately send it to the relevant organization. So the collaboration that takes place mainly is that if a matter can best be dealt with by another Chapter 9 or whatever, I refer that matter formally to that specific Chapter 9.
Thank you very much. You see, we have to report to Parliament the proliferation of bodies, not only 11, by the way. Parliament appoints another 18 bodies, by the way, 29 bodies. And all we hear so far from Chapter 9 bodies in particular is a reactive view. We will collaborate in a particular case. The proactive position is we will work together to sell ourselves. Proactive thing like the Freedom of Information thing, say, we'll work out special arrangements for the future, so that this is how things will be done. That's lacking so far. It's not a finding, but we will have to take that into account when we go to Parliament, as to exactly the nature of collaboration. You see, we're a relatively poor country. Every Chapter 9 body wants more money, which will come to the moment, systematically. They don't tell us exactly why they need the more money, but if we had more money, we would do this. You don't need money to work on collaborative programs with Chapter 9 bodies and other 9, 10, 11, 12, and sections, Article 6 bodies. Advocate, you finished.
The question was more specifically focusing on Chapter 8 and specifically the prosecution authority, because both institutions have investigative power. And in the ad hoc committee, I was trying to juggle the public protector's memory about, which occurs here in Parliament. That issue arose sharply. And the recommendation was that the two institutions should develop some kind of framework on how to collaborate in situations where the prosecuting authority would actually be conducting an investigation. There's a specific situation.
And then we come to the Simmons and we'll move on. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Specifically, I would say there has not been any formal collaboration between the NPA and the public protector. On an ad hoc basis, what has been happening is that when we analyze, for instance, the complaint, and it is clear from the onset that this amount of corruption amounts to a crime, we totally do not participate in that one. We refer it to the NPA. But if at the end of the investigation of the NPA, we still feel that there is still room for us, and then we zoom in. But that has not happened in practice. Where we have referred the matter is either they have dealt with the matter to finality and the matter has not come back to us. To give an example, because it might be important to give concrete examples so that you understand what I'm saying. I remember the case in the Western Cape of the former Premier and Malat came to us first. It is one specific case where we specifically referred it back to the NPA because we felt it's more of a criminal nature and the NPA was best located to deal with the matter. We referred it to them and they have dealt with the case to finality and there is still no need for us to go into that matter. But this all I can say is that there has been no formal arrangement that has been made and that's what is lacking.
On this point, Mr. Van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chairperson. Your relationship with the NPA and the Justice Department, let's just go back to the appeals, because you say you have large numbers of complaints about appeals taking time. Now, how do you go into the systemic situation that you referred to, because a week or so ago, the Justice Committee had a briefing by Advocate Sithole, the Deputy Director General, on the issue of appeals. They told us that there are 6,000 in arrear, and I don't know how they're going to do that. So what is your role then there? You get complaints, they sit with the problem, how do you help them to solve the problem?
Thank you, Chairperson. In terms of the appeals, the complaints that come in directly to our office is in relation to the delays in setting the matter down for the hearing on the court cross. So with regard to the systemic investigation regarding appeals particularly, what we've done is that, I mean, currently we are engaging both the NPA, because they've got a role, as well as the Department of Justice. What we're picking up in that matter is that there are no systems between justice, the court, as well as the correctional services. They don't have systems. They don't have systems and procedure in terms of how to deal with those appeals. So our investigation is around those systems. How do they process an appeal? For instance, if I were to make an example, in the various courts, they don't have, like, for instance, a database or maybe a record of how they record the application for appeals. They do it manually. And in terms of following up on those cases, they don't have systems in place. And when it comes to correctional services normally transfers prisoner from one center to the other. They also don't have a database that is up to date, that can be accessible to all the correctional centers if a prisoner has been transferred. So there isn't any synergy between the department. So what we're doing into that investigation is that we're looking at all the three bodies that are administering appeals, and we're coming up with recommendations in terms of how they can improve their system. The other area which is also outside our jurisdiction, but we're also going to touch it, is the capacity within the court, which is leading to those backlogs. We are going to touch on that in our final report regarding appeals, because we realize that, I mean, most of the courts are running 2 years behind in terms of setting the matter down on the road. And it's also leading to some of the complaints coming to our office, because clearly there's that capacity in terms of the appointment of the members of the judiciary.
There was an article in the Sunday Times this Sunday of a man who waited 4 years in prison for his appeal to be heard, and then he was found not guilty. So he spent 4 years as an innocent man in prison. Have you seen that? Are you taking any action there?
Thank you, Chair. We are. We've noted some of those cases, and we've even done our own investigation. What we picked up is that, I mean, most of those appeals, even though they are delayed, there's a 30% chance of success in most of the appeals. And that is why I say, in some instances, some of the things, I mean, there was no certificate. I mean, it's a lack of capacity within some of the high courts. The number of judges that are available in the courts is supposed to be. But we are noting all those cases and we are dealing with them as well.
Can I add, sir?
No, please. I think we've had a full answer. I'm a little concerned. We're still on 1 and 2, right? We have 23 to go to, right? There's a very important question about complaints mechanism, members of the public. You have a complaints mechanism against you, right? We're dissatisfied with the work your officers were. How many complaints have you received, and what recommendations you made? The complaints have made about your work, which is very important to us in the committee. So rather than looking at, for example, miscarriage of justice and all, what happens here when a complaint made against the office, and how do you deal with it?
I think we have tried to explain in detail in our responses, because these complaints that we received, Firstly, some mainly they come through either the president, and some of them come from the Speaker of Parliament, and lately we received some that came from the through the committee. And what we do, we look at the origin of that complaint. We have got investigative units in the office. We have got two units at the national office and a special unit at the national office, and then the various provinces, each constitute a unit. And once these complaints come, they are reported, the complaints are reported to me, and then I refer it to a specific unit with specific instructions on how to deal with each complaint up to a finality. And obviously, the complaints that we receive, I wouldn't say there are many. We have received complaints, but to be honest, there have been very minimal that we have received.
Can you give us some figures for the last 5 years, then, please?
It will be difficult to...
Well, don't you have computers putting down these things?
Statistically. Yeah, but...
There must be a database, because we're going to ask questions a little later. How many complaints do you get from prisons? Things like that. But that's about your efficacy. You know, because we, otherwise we're going to say there might be special machinery for prisons, for example. Just for a recommendation. So, must be a database on it.
I think we have to check that one, because if I give you a guesswork, then I will be held to that one. But we need to check and give you a precise number, which relatively it's not many.
No, what we want is how many in the last 5 years, how they've been dealt with, and whether the president's been informed about or whoever has written to you, and the person concerned. In other words, the process also. We want one sheet of paper. Thank you. Only 5 minutes, and the usual rule is, please, the our guest parliament's guests first for tea, then members of the committee, and of course our friends or visitors here after that. The staff and the chairperson last.
We're going to move on to Parliament and the relationship to Parliament. Very interesting, good one. After that, after your question.